Governor Scott Walker signs bills to eliminate the state's election board and overhaul campaign finance laws. In this edition of the Week in Review, we will talk about what these measures mean and what they will mean for Wisconsin politics. We will also get our guest to discuss this week's Republican presidential debate and preview the upcoming Democratic presidential debate. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. What political issue from the past week do you want to discuss? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guests are John Sharpless, a professor of history at UW-Madison. Good morning.
Good morning.
And also Tony Palmieri, a communications professor at UW-Oshkosh and a media columnist for the Fox Valley Scene. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you both with us. So let's start off with state news. Governor Walker signed into law this week bills that eliminate the Government Accountability Board. It replaces the Government Accountability Board and also rewrites campaign finance laws. John Sharpless, let's go to you first. Your general thoughts of doing away with the Government Accountability Board and replacing it with two separate panels to monitor elections and ethics.
I'm not troubled with having two separate panels. That may, I suspect that will work just as well. What I was a bit troubled by is that they're replacing the membership was presently as nonpartisan. They try to seek people who aren't identified with the political parties, their former judges. And what's going to happen is the positions now will be filled by old political cronies, and so it will simply be it'll be the politicians looking after the politicians. So the fox will look after the hen house. That's what troubles me most. Having two separate boards, that may well work out just fine.
Yeah, even though they say it'll be bipartisan, if partisan.
It's partisan. I think these kinds of boards should be nonpartisan. I'm kind of old-fashioned Midwesterner. I think there's some things, if you want to put there are some things that certainly ex-politicians and current politicians can serve on, but things that administrate political activity, I think, should be as close to nonpartisan as possible.
Mm-hmm. Tony?
The fact that the governor signed these bills in a private ceremony should tell us something. We only found out about the fact that he signed them when the bill's author sent out a tweet, I believe. The Government Accountability Board was nationally recognized for its effectiveness, as John suggests. It was nonpartisan. Obviously, the politicians did not like that the GAB was doing its job, and so they dismantled it. And essentially now we're back to partisan control of ethics and elections, and it means essentially that we're going to recreate the same conditions that created the caucus scandal in 2001 and thereabouts. So really, it's a shame and a disgrace. And I do hope that the people are listening, because this is, you know, we've got obviously problems in the state with job creation, but I think what the politicians made clear yesterday with the governor signing this bill is that they are concerned about jobs, their own, and that's a real problem.
Well, John, what do you say about Republicans who say that the Government Accountability Board conducted itself in a partisan manner in with regards to the recall and John Doe and other issues?
Well, I'd separate the John Doe investigation that came out of Milwaukee's prosecutor office. Well, clearly the Republicans are in a pout. Being an old Republican, I'm troubled with legislation that's driven by vengeance and not by good public policy. They're angry about a bunch of things, and they're going after things that embarrass them. I'm a little less cynical about this than Tony. I do think it's possible that these two boards can function legitimately. It remains to be seen.
The campaign finance bill doubles the limit for individual campaign contributions. It eliminates a requirement that donors giving more than $100 identify their employer. It clarifies that candidates can coordinate with outside groups on issue ads. Tony, what do you think of the changing of the rules for campaign finance laws?
Other than the Republicans who voted for this, I don't know of anyone in the state who thinks we need more money in politics. And they've now made it more difficult to investigate who is actually giving money. What's interesting is that they will often say, well, we don't really need public financing of campaigns. What we need is more transparency. We need to know who is giving and how much they're giving. Well, clearly they don't believe that, because this legislation is going to make it more difficult to know who's giving. It now explicitly makes legal a kind of campaign coordination between candidates and special interests that before this was either illegal or at least highly suspect. So as with the dismantling of the GAB, I think that the Republican majority is setting us on a path that is probably going to give us more corruption, more cynicism towards state government, but it will solidify special interest control of the legislature and the governor's office, and that's a real tragedy in my judgment.
Any problems with these changes, John?
I'm going to side with Tony on this. I'm not worried about the amount of money. I just think people should have the guts to identify themselves with what they say. I think the First Amendment protects your right of speech, but it doesn't protect any kind of right of anonymity. You have to know who's paying the money, who's putting on the table. And I think Tony's right. This has made it very difficult to know. Particularly, I'm troubled by the ending the requirement that you put down your employer for large donations. I'm a little surprised that members of the legislature want to have people who work for foreign governments and perhaps terrorist groups or for organizations that advocate the overthrow of the United States government making secret contributions to state campaigns. You could easily have an employee of the Chinese government now subsidizing some politician's campaign for office, and we would never know about it.
Let's go to the phones. Randy in Key Wascom is with us. Hi, Randy.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. In regards to the Government Accountability Board, in theory, it's a great idea. The problem was this board was far from nonpartisan. In fact, yesterday in court, they had, Eric O'Keefe brought suit against them, and they admitted in court to wrongdoing, and they are finally going to release the tens of thousands of emails and other correspondence relating to the John Doe witch hunt, and it's going to be interesting to see what's all in there. Unfortunately, a lot of the media has been cheerleading for the John Doe and won't take a look at this stuff and pretend it isn't there.
And Randy, I'm not familiar with what wrongdoing was admitted to.
Well, the fact that they were they were engaged in the witch hunt. They weren't just advising. They were engaged. You had lawyers on the Government Accountability Board that were working with the John Chisholm and the John Doe to go after any pretty much every conservative group in the state.
Well, what the story I saw was the Government Accountability Board. Randy, the Government Accountability Board insisted it did nothing wrong. So I don't know what you're talking
about.
Well,
they conceded in court yesterday.
We'll have to look that up because I'm not familiar with that. Are you John Sharpless of any admission of wrongdoing?
I didn't see that revelation. Up to this point, the Government Accountability Board has claimed that they've kept distance from the John Doe investigation.
I guess there was an agreement. Bill looked it up. Bill Martin's my producer. The agreement contains no admissions of wrongdoing or liability by the Government Accountability Board or its staff, nor will the board pay any of the plaintiff's legal costs. So,
I had a lot of trouble with the John Doe investigation personally. I saw it as very similar to And I'm kind of surprised that liberal Democrats didn't see a parallel here to what happened in the Clinton administration, where he was subject to a prolonged investigation, kind of waiting for a crime to be committed. If there had really been a smoking gun, it would have been revealed early in that investigation. And so I don't think you can have a John Doe investigation that goes on and on and on and on and on and on. At some point, you have to pay up or shut up. Perhaps the initial accusations had to be investigated. That's fine. But at some point, you just end it. You don't continue it. I don't think Walker should have been subjected to continuous investigation throughout his first term in office.
Tony?
I disagree with John on this. I think that the Government Accountability Board was doing its job very conscientiously on the John Doe. In fact, your listeners should know that the Republican legislature has now eliminated John Doe proceedings for political corruption, which is just fascinating when you think about that. The major tool we had to get at corruption in state government has now been eliminated by the legislature, which is really outrageous. If you look at the members of the Government Accountability Board who are most outraged by their dismantling, it has been those judges that in their previous service before the GAB were Republicans. So they know that what's going on here is based on political vendetta and vengeance. I do agree with John that John Doe proceedings should not go on endlessly. This particular John Doe proceeding was actively undermined and disrupted, and that's unfortunate. And now to go further, as I said, they've now made it impossible for John Doe proceedings to be used to get at political corruption, and that's really sad for our state.
We are talking about the news of the week during this, the Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine with Tony Palmieri and John Sharpless. If you'd like to join in with an issue in the news this week, you can call 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Week in Review on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, talking today with John Sharpless, a professor of history at UW-Madison, and Tony Palmieri, a communications professor at UW-Oshkosh and media columnist for the Fox Valley Scene. Welcoming the political issue from the news this week that you want to discuss, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let's go back to the phones. Joan in Rudolph is with us. Hi, Joan.
Wisconsin used to pride itself with being an open and honest government. And with the recent revelation of the WEDAC and another division chief admitting that Governor Walker's administration had instructed them not to basically use government communication systems, when he first started his administration in 2011. And I can't understand how we as Wisconsinites can accept this, especially when he as county executive and his staff there were convicted of using a secret email system. And it seems to me that, and then the attempt in early summer there to change the open records laws. And it seems to me that whenever he is caught or investigated with doing something against the state law, he then attempts to change the state law. And, we are becoming a secretive government now under his administration. And as, as Republicans also in the state legislature, they're doing the same thing.
Joan, I'm going to jump in because I want to make sure that listeners are up to date on the story you're talking about. State officials are now backing away from a move to cut back on record-keeping requirements. This is after a backlash by open government advocates. The board that oversees state public records will now revisit its August vote on so-called transitory records, like texts, messages, or other messages deemed to have only temporary value. The announcement came 3 days after the Wisconsin Freedom from Information Council filed a complaint in Dane County alleging that the board had violated the state's open meetings law with its August meeting when it approved these changes. So it violated the open meetings law when it changed open records laws to eliminate text messages from the requirement. But now it's backing off of that. Tony, you want to start us off on your reaction to this issue?
Well, first of all, I think that Joan, our caller, is 100% correct. There's been really an attack on openness and transparency in state government. John Sharpless, I think earlier, referred to himself as an old-fashioned Republican. The old-time Republicans were champions of open government and transparency. And the current Republicans, the governor, the legislative majority, clearly are not champions of that. And so it's time for people like Joan and all of us citizens at large to make them know that this is not going to be tolerated, that it is government of the people. It is not government of special interests conducting its business in secret. So, many thanks for Joan for speaking out about issues like this. We need a lot more people to do it.
Mm-hmm. John Sharpless?
Well, if you want to change this, you're going to have a more aggressive Democratic Party in this
yep.
state. And the Democrats, I would blame for their inefficiency and muddling of their campaigns. They've just been awful. They've had three chances to defeat Walker, and they haven't. So until the Democrats figure out how to make a campaign work, the people of this state are going to have Walker or someone like him as their governor. I am troubled by this. I do think that the pendulum will swing. There'll be a reaction to this. I think the reaction, I think, has to come within the Republican Party. It has to come from people who believe in the tradition of clean and open government. And until that happens, this will continue.
Since we have two UW professors with us, let's talk about the recent UW System Board of Regents ruling on freedom of speech. It voted 16-2 on last Friday to affirm free speech and academic freedom, joining colleges across the country that have proclaimed devotion to free expression. Concerns from academia trying to protect students from being offended. I know, John Sharpless, you mentioned you worked on this issue. What were you hoping? What are you hoping comes out of this?
Well, actually, our concern, and I did have a small contribution to that final statement, which frankly I think reads like it was written by a professor. It's pretty turgid. What actually provoked us to be concerned and approach the regents for a statement had little to do with recent issues on campuses at all. It was way back in May, and our issue that provoked us was discussions around tenure. And a complaint either from a student or from the legislature or from a fellow faculty member about being offended by a fellow professor's commentary, say, to the press, Tony and I right now, for example, leading to the revoking of their tenure. That's what led us to start this thing. Now, in the interim, there's been a debate about student minorities speaking up and being concerned about the atmosphere on campus and whether or not the speech of other students or of faculty might lead to some hurt on their part. Our feeling is, and we were successful in getting the regents to pass this motion, that by and large, it's for the best on the campus and for this nation to have an open and free discussion of issues. That's the American way. And it's also in the Constitution of the United States. And as a public university, we're obliged to follow the Constitution of the United States. Now, if you read the statement, there are some limitations on that. Obviously, and I think Tony would agree on this, as professionals, when you're standing in front of a classroom, you apply certain restraints on yourself. I teach American history. And I teach 1945 to the present. There are a lot of controversial issues, gender and race, foreign policy issues. What I try to do in the class is I will state the various perspectives on a problem, and I may at some point in that lecture say, and my opinion is, and then I'll state my opinion, but I'm always cautious to embed it in other points of view. I should be able to do that. I really believe in the First Amendment very deeply. It's my job. I'm paid to talk. Being on this show, I want to feel as if I can make my statements and not be worried that when I get back to my department, I'm going to get fired. This statement protects that. And by the way, what it does is reaffirm a set of statements by our regents going all the way back to the early 20th century when the university was protecting one of their most famous professors, Richard T. Ely, from the legislature that wanted to have him fired.
Tony.
Well, you know, I agree with everything that John has said. I think that public universities especially have to be the marketplace of ideas. I mean, we need the widest expression possible. But there is, of course, a balancing act in the classroom. I mean, there's all this hype these days about students being offended and not wanting to hear different points of view. I think if you look at these issues seriously, when there are expressions of racist or sexist speech that can be interpreted as harassment, that goes beyond a person just being offended. And to just simply throw up your arms and say, oh, we have free speech, everyone should be able to say what they want, I just think that takes the easy way out. There does need to be the widest expression possible, but there does need to be an opportunity for students who are feeling harassed to have an avenue to express that concern. Yeah, as far as the professors go, John Sharpless is you know, right on point here. It's just horrendous that a growing number of professionals around the country have to feel that their speech is being micromanaged by someone in power, and that they could lose their position as a result of what they say. That is about as contrary to the First Amendment as you can get. So, you know, we do need to protect the right of people to state their views, you know, A, without feeling they're going to lose their job because of it, and I think B, just as important, without feeling they have to constantly self-censor themselves so as to avoid any kind of political pressure.
Well, we thank you both for expressing your views on this show. This is The Week in Review on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We talk with two guests from different perspectives about the top issues in the news each week. Today, we are talking with Tony Palmieri, a communications professor at UW-Oshkosh, and John Sharpless, a professor of history at UW-Madison. 1-800-642-1234. If there is a news story or an issue in the news this week that you would like us to discuss, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let's talk a little bit about the latest jobs numbers. According to the latest gold standard job numbers from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, Wisconsin is 37th in the nation in private sector job growth from June of 2014 to June of 2015. So 37th in the nation. We're also ranked 8th out of the 10 Midwestern states. Nearly 31,000 private sector jobs were created in those 12 months. That's 1.3% growth rate. The national rate was 2.3%. But our employment rate is 4.2%, which is below the national average and the lowest it's been in more than a decade. All right, so just your general assessment, Tony, on how Wisconsin is doing on jobs?
I don't think anyone would say Honestly, that we're doing well. And as far as our government's impact on this, our governor spent the last year preparing for and then running for president, being somewhat uninvolved in the budget deliberations. Our legislature, as I think has been quite obvious based on our opening discussion on this program, has been more concerned with politics than they have been with the economy. The governor's flagship organization to promote economic development, the WEDC, has been a disaster. I don't think anyone disputes that. And really, we only need to look immediately to our west at Minnesota, a state that has done pretty much everything the opposite of Wisconsin since 2010. Nothing equivalent to an Act 10. No crony type of board like the WEDC. Their governor, I think most people would call a moderate to a liberal Democrat. They have not used draconian cuts to K-12 and university. And on every major economic indicator, Minnesota does better than Wisconsin. So I think a strong argument can be made and needs to be made, as John suggests, more strongly by the Democratic Party, that we've been going in the wrong direction in this state. And only when policies do change at the state level, at a minimum, something needs to be done with that WEDC. My preference would be to go back to putting an entity like that back in state government where it can be more accountable. And you know, until we do things like that, I think we're going to continue to see these very, very disappointing numbers.
John?
Well, I think state governments as a whole waste an enormous amount of resources trying to lure industry. It almost inevitably becomes an environment of special privilege. So I tend to be, I believe that state government should, by and large, stay out of the game of competing with other states for industries. That's just my personal point of view, because it always leads to cronyism. It always leads to infighting. Which industry is deserving? Which particular entrepreneur deserves the privilege of having state funds siphoned off into his project? It didn't work in Wisconsin. It seldom works elsewhere. The comparison with Minnesota is, to some extent, I would say, inappropriate. Minnesota doesn't have the equivalent of a Milwaukee and a Racine. Minnesota never had its urban growth being driven by the old industrial complex that has now declined and the jobs have left. In this state, our urban areas along the east coast of the state continue to struggle in terms of employment and attracting business. It's not the same as the Twin Cities area, which is largely commercial and financially driven. Minnesota may have made some wise choices, or may not, but they don't struggle with the same problems of industrial structure that has largely been abandoned. They don't have a Milwaukee. They have a Minneapolis.
Speaking of jobs, union workers at the Kohler Company are back at work after a month-long strike. Members voted overwhelmingly in favor of a 4-year deal this week on Wednesday. Union leaders say the new agreement provides a wage increase in each year of the contract and improves health care costs compared to the company's previous offer. According to the union president, the agreement significantly brings the one-tier associate pay closer to the other. There was a dispute over this two-tiered payment system going on at Kohler. The union said the two-tiered system unfairly limited new employees to roughly $13 an hour. And Kohler CEO warned without the two-tiered system, local manufacturing jobs would likely disappear. Kohler now says it can stay competitive, and the strike is over. Tony, you're not too far away from Kohler. Your thoughts on this strike and the agreement?
Well, I think you're right that the main issue in that strike was that two-tier wage system. And You know, we can understand why the workers were desperate to get back to work, especially in a holiday season, but unfortunately that two-tier system does remain. That you know, maybe the bottom tier might top out at maybe $13 an hour at this point, and I think the top tier might be around $23 an hour. This, by the way, at a time when Kohler is making, I believe, record profits in the history of the company. So it's good that they reached an agreement. I don't think it got as far as the workers wanted. You know, again, to take another criticism of the Democratic Party, I think that there were some state Democrats that sent out press releases and, you know, did openly support the strike. But I think this is an example of where if the Democratic Party wants to become a major player in state politics, I think that this issue of the strike at Kohler would have been one to rally around. I mean, let's face it, when state workers protested against Governor Walker, the Democratic Party was out in full force. This is a different type of worker at Kohler, and I didn't see a bunch of elected officials out there on the picket line with the workers. And these are middle-class people, or these are people struggling to get into the middle class. And I do think a thriving, relevant Democratic Party really ought to be behind those folks more visibly and more persistently than we saw over the last month.
Yeah, you want to pile on the Democratic Party on this one, John?
Oh, I'd love to, but I'm Tony's already done it. The only comment I'll make is I don't think we have the complete details of the settlement. One of the things that goes on in labor management give and take is that everybody gives in on one side or another as part of the ritual. I think what's impressive here is that there was indeed a strike. Strikes have grown, are really an unusual phenomenon today because working people are fearful that the plant will simply close down and go elsewhere. They did strike. They did get an agreement. It might not be the agreement that they wanted, but I found it, as a historian, an interesting moment that we don't see very often anymore. The classic complaint on the part of the workers, the strike, the negotiations, the settlement, that ritual has largely disappeared from America. And I think there's something to be said for its return. Maybe workers have to test capital in order for capital to be more responsible.
There is a state bill in the state legislature that would force the Wisconsin Historical Society to allow the owners of a limestone quarry in Dane County to excavate a 3-acre plot in order to prove whether human remains are actually buried in these effigy mounds. Wingrove Stone and Ready Mix have reportedly been mining around the plot for 2 decades. The Ho-Chunk Nation says history suggests this is a protected burial site, but Wingrove Stone says there's no proof of that. The bill would allow the excavation to see if there are human remains there. John Sharpless, do you have any feelings on how this matter should be resolved?
I should have a disclaimer here. My daughter has a master's in archaeology.
Oh, really?
And, in fact, has worked in excavating and studying Indian mounds. So I've got to be careful here. I don't come out on the side of bulldozing Indian mounds. Actually, there's a whole apparatus that's already in the legal system to deal with this, and I don't know the details of this problem. The state is obliged to bring in teams of archaeologists to determine whether or not the construction, either by public construction or private construction, can proceed. I don't know why this has been stalled. I might say what troubles me about this is apparently it's moving through the courts slowly for some. I don't know the details, and I don't know why it's moving so slowly. There is a set of legislation that deals with this very particular problem. This is not something new. All over this state, they're usually private archaeology firms are brought in to do an assessment. They come up, it's called rapid assessment. They come in and they do the assessment and they present it to governmental authorities, they present it to the companies, and then you can dispute it. What bothers me about this is special privilege laws. Can I get in line? This notion that particular companies and particular individuals should receive special privilege from the legislature and the government. By the way, I'd like to pay no taxes. Can I be next in line?
Get a bill for that.
Maybe I have to write out a check to the governor and then I don't have to pay taxes anymore. I just don't like the legislature and the government circumventing the courts and usual administrative boards.
Yeah. So presumably, perhaps, Wingra Stone wanted this bill introduced to allow it to excavate this area. Apparently, the Historical Society is saying, no, there are remains there, so don't you can't go there. And Wingra is saying, we don't think there are remains there. So, in any case, Tony, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I mean, there's a question that our state needs to ask. Does the quest for more and more profit outweigh history, tradition, culture, and what have you? As John Sharpless just said, there is a legal process to handle these matters, but we've now created this ethic, if you will, in state government that especially big, profitable industry can get the ear of someone in the legislature and now possibly force a bill that will circumvent the legal process. And, you know, I think it's unfortunate. You know, isn't Dane County especially known for these types of mounds? I mean, I think that is one thing that is, you know, part of the whole character of the area. So,
Tony, you're not suggesting we have too many mounds.
I don't know.
Well, you know, and there is. We'll probably do more on this in next week or the week after. We are. I know that there are a lot of effigy mounds that do
right.
not have human remains in them either.
Absolutely. I think most of them do not. You do know that Bascom Hill had effigy mounds on the top of it.
I did not know that.
Yeah, that's why this campus is haunted. We violated the burial site of Native Americans, and we will forever suffer.
That accounts for a lot. All right, we have to take our break. We're late on our break, and then when we come back, we'll talk about presidential campaign stuff. There was the GOP debate this week, and lots of issues of national importance that we should talk about, too. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is The Week in Review on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Every week at this time, we welcome in two guests from different perspectives to talk about the top issues in state and national news each week. Today, we are talking with John Sharpless, a professor of history at UW-Madison, and Tony Palmieri, a communications professor at UW-Oshkosh. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We will get to some national issues in just a moment, but one other state issue on the table. Republican State Senator Van Wongard, who chairs the Senate Judiciary Committee, has rejected a call for a hearing on allegations of inmate abuse at Wisconsin's youth prison that is known as Lincoln Hills. Wongard said a hearing could jeopardize an ongoing investigation, but promised to keep an eye on the situation. Governor Walker says that since policy and personnel changes have been made at Lincoln Hills, juvenile prisons are safe. John, you first. Any concerns about Lincoln Hills, or are you confident when Governor Walker insists that juvenile prisons are safe? Do you think there should be a hearing?
I don't know. Maybe you should spend some time there to see if they're safe. I do think there's something to be said for not having a state hearing while the investigation is taking place. I would hope at some point the legislature looks into the management of these institutions. I think the head of corrections needs to explain why these institutions have not been governed properly, and that the young people that are in them are exposed to predators. The head of corrections should be called to task. As a Republican, I demanded that Hillary Clinton be called to task for Benghazi. If you're at the head of the agency, you have to explain why something bad happened on your watch, even if you're not directly involved in that. That's why you're head of the agency, and I think the head of corrections has something to explain here.
Mm-hmm. Tony?
I think there should be a hearing. I mean, whatever happened to the independent committee chair who goes against the will of the governor's office and decides to just look into something that clearly is a problem? I don't see how the legislature doing its job would somehow undermine an investigation. If anything, it might create another level of accountability so that that investigation does do its due diligence. So I would hope that the Republican committee chairs would stop this constant pattern of protecting the governor's office, protecting whatever allies they have in state government, and do what the legislature is charged with doing. We've got a clear problem with this prison system, and what else would a Judiciary Committee do but investigate things like this?
Here's the problem, Tony. If people are called as witnesses before a legislative investigating committee, it is an opportunity for them to escape criminal punishment later on by saying that they self-incriminated, they were forced to self-incriminate before that legislative committee. That's happened at the national level and it's happened at the state level. And the problem is that these investigating committees, if they conduct their investigation during a period in which there's an investigation for criminal activity, you can contaminate the criminal activity in a way that will actually undermine the criminal prosecution of people involved in the controversy.
We'll have more on this issue coming up on our state capitol report on Monday. We will be talking with State Senator John Erpenbach, who renewed his call this week for an audit of the Department of Corrections. So we'll talk more about this on Monday during our state capitol report. We really should move on to some other national issues. Let's move on to the presidential race. Republicans had their fifth debate, the last one of 2015. It was pretty lively, lots of fireworks. Donald Trump defended his call to ban Muslims from entering the country. Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz sparred over immigration, lots of other things. But what impressed you, John Sharpless, first? What did you take away from the GOP debate?
Well, let me confess that when it actually happened live, I was at the basketball game watching Bo coach for the last time.
Yeah.
By the way, he coached very poorly. Clearly, his mind was elsewhere. Then I came home to watch the replay, and I shut it off after a moment, which I found so distressing, I really couldn't finish the debate.
Why was it so distressing?
That was the discussion between Ben Carson and Donald Trump on punishing the families of terrorists. The notion that we're going to have the American military walk into the homes of people and shoot them in the face because their cousin or their uncle was joined a terrorist group is appalling. We will have a hard time recruiting for that armed forces. I can't imagine an ad that's on television that says, join the army so you can kill a baby. Our national foreign policy should not be driven by vengeance.
Tony, what was your takeaway from the GOP debate?
Well, I wish I'd been at the basketball game. Usually I find the Republican debate somewhat amusing. You know, it's usually a contest of who can make the most over-the-top statement. This one was actually quite frightening. The entire debate was based on fear, and there was very little optimism in that debate. The doom and gloom, Chris Christie, I thought, set the tone, which was horrific, you know, referring to Barack Obama as someone who's betrayed the country, stoking fear about what happened in Los Angeles. You know, I walked away from that thinking, I don't think anyone on that stage is will be able to defeat Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders or Martin O'Malley, whoever gets the Democratic nomination. There's got to be some feeling of optimism and hope. You know, I think John Kasich in some ways is trying to be that kind of candidate, but his debating skills are really not very good. And I think Trump has so completely dominated this that, you know, he's making people like Ted Cruz seem a little bit moderate, which is fascinating that anybody could do that. So, yeah, I agree with John Sharpless. So it was somewhat distressing as a debate. And I do think that the Republicans should be a little bit worried at this point that they're going to nominate someone who just will not be electable in a general election.
Yeah, well, are they going to nominate Donald Trump, John Sharpless? That the one national poll out this week has him, you know, 41% over his closest rival, Ted Cruz, who has 14%.
I have to say that most of the athletic teams that I have predicted this year have done less than when I predicted. I'm not very good at predicting outcomes. I'm going to go along with what seems to be the sort of mantra among political pundits, is that as it gets closer and closer to the convention, many Republicans will have a second thought about whether they want to be represented by Trump, and that the support for him will winnow away and find its support elsewhere. Let me say that I was impressed. The only two people that challenged Ben Carson and Donald Trump on punishing the families of terrorists were Rand Paul, who said that it would be a direct violation of the Geneva Convention, and Jeb Bush, who spoke from his heart very poorly. He was shocked that that was the discussion that was going on, so he dissented. The rest were silent. That's not American. It's not Republican. And I would, for all these men claim to be Christians, it's not Christian. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. I believe that's Romans, is it 2 or 12, whatever it is. A foreign policy driven by vengeance is bound to fail. It's simply that's the problem. There was dissent there. I'm a Kasich fan, but as Tony points out, he doesn't seem to have the debating skills necessary to compete. And frankly, he doesn't make the kind of broad, absurd statements that Trump makes.
You know, we have less than a minute, but we should talk very briefly. Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton says when it comes to terror, we cannot give in to fear. And she had a speech on how she would deal with ISIS this week. There is a Democratic debate on Saturday. Tony, maybe we can just a quick preview. What are you going to be looking for?
Well, I mean, I do think that the Democrats in general need to go beyond a kind of Republican light foreign policy. I mean, it's fine to critique some of the absurdities we're finding in the Republican debate, but if they come out and continue to support drone strikes, continue to just double down on bombing, you know, that at some point the Democratic Party needs to set out a position on foreign policy that is substantially different than what the Bush administration created for us, years ago. So I'm looking to see that there is some type of, you know, idealism, if you will, in foreign policy that will get us to a point where we can say, yes, this war on terror will come to an end, and how will you do that?
Yeah, well, last word for the Week in Review for this week. Thank you both very much for being with us.
Well, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
John Sharpless, professor of history at UW-Madison, and Tony Palmieri, a communications professor at UW-Oshkosh. Thanks to Bill Martins for producing and directing the program. Thanks to Elizabeth Delaquest for on-air production. Thank you for listening. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.